The Battle for Liberty, Episode 9.
This is the Battle for Liberty.
All right, welcome back to another episode of the Battle for Liberty. Once again, I'm your host, Mike Tilden. I'd like to welcome you to the podcast dedicated to the journey of the libertarian novice. So happy you've joined us here today to listen to us talk about libertarian philosophy and everything that it stands for and all of the logical conclusions that we find ourselves arriving at. I want you to subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher. Before we start anything, you got to go over there, subscribe on iTunes and Stitcher. It really helps me out. And if you can go one step farther and tell a friend about the show, I'd really appreciate it. If you can help me grow that listener base, it's going to be good for all of us. As always, you should check us out on the website at battleforliberty.com. You should follow me on Twitter at @mybattleliberty. And if you want, you can email me at mike@battleforliberty.com. As usual, we'll have a show notes page for today, and that show notes page is battleforliberty.com/9. That's one convenient location where you can get all of the content that we refer to in this episode right at your fingertips without having to memorize a long, complicated web address. So battleforliberty.com/9, and everything we talk about today is going to be posted right there for you. All right, that's it for the introduction. I'd love to just jump right in. A little bit of a personal update. I know I missed the Friday deadline again this week, and this is unfortunately becoming a trend. I think it's quite possible that my release date is going to shift a little. It's become a little less consistent that I get episodes out on Friday mornings. The first 7 episodes or so, I was able to do that, but I'm still getting used to a new schedule because of a new job, and it just so happens that I'm able to do a lot more over the weekend, and so you can expect Sunday or Monday releases when we do have an episode. So that brings us into the next topic, which is that it's highly likely that I won't be able to record an episode and get one out by this Friday, possibly not even at all this next week. So we may skip a week, and this is due to another travel week that I have coming up, but this time it's vacation and not work. You'll notice that when I'm on my work travel weeks, I do everything I can to get an episode published and out, but this time it's vacation, and it's a pretty good one, so I won't be taking a microphone with me, and I won't be recording an episode. A close friend of ours is getting married in the Pittsburgh area, and so the wife and I are flying out to the good old Yinzer paradise to take part in the nuptials. So this will actually mark the very first time that we've taken a vacation without our children, so we're really not quite sure what we're going to do with ourselves. But I won't be podcasting, I can almost promise that. So for this one week only, I've decided I'm going to be a little bit generous and tell you that in lieu of the Battle for Liberty podcast, I will officially give you a hall pass to cheat on me and patronize someone else's podcast. All right, obviously that's a little bit of a joke, but in all seriousness, I really do. I'm going to take this time to recommend to you another podcast that I enjoy on a weekly basis, and that's the Libertarians on Fire podcast. My friend Rick Rivers is running that podcast, and I think he's just doing an amazing job. It's a great show. I think you'll get a lot from it if you're not already listening to it. And I'm not sure what's coming this Friday, but if it's what I think it is, I'm actually really excited for it too. So on my vacation, I'm going to be listening to it. So I would hope that you would do the same. Go on over there, Libertarians on Fire, subscribe to that one, and it's going to do you a world of good. All right, that's it for all the introductions and all the updates and things of that nature. I'd like to jump right in at this point to the topic of the show. And the topic of today's show is the concept of voluntarism. Voluntarism is an incredibly interesting philosophy that relates very closely to libertarian philosophy and anarchy and anarcho-capitalism, and I want to discuss it today here on the show. And the reason that it came to my mind and the reason that it's at the forefront is because I was listening to another podcast that I listen to quite frequently, which is called Part of the Problem, and it's hosted by Dave Smith. If you're not already listening to Dave's Part of the Problem podcast, you need to start doing that. Dave is informative and just incredibly intelligent and really knows his stuff, but he takes it a step further and he's really funny. He's actually a comic by trade, and that really helps him out. It's just a very enjoyable show. I find myself laughing and nodding as I'm listening to it. So that's a really another good one that you're going to want to go listen to. But they recently did a podcast, which at its heart, it was refuting a video by the Young Turks that came out recently, in which the host of this particular segment of the Young Turks, he called it Libertarianism Debunked. And, you know, he tried to throw up some straw man arguments about libertarianism and just generally did a horrible, horrible job of representing what libertarianism is in the first place. And Dave and his co-hosts did an awesome job refuting it. And I really think you should listen to that in its entirety. But that's the jumping off point. But the point that I'm going to be making is in reference to the beginning portion of that show, during which Dave and the co-hosts introduced the idea of voluntarism. Now, we have to start out by defining what that term means. So, at its core, voluntarism is a very simple philosophy which holds that all interactions between human beings should be voluntary and free of coercion. And what this means is that the use of force in all forms is prohibited. So, that would include theft, robbery, slavery, assault, rape, murder, and threats of those acts. It's oftentimes seen as a corollary to anarcho-capitalism, and I kind of see it as a brother philosophy to anarchy and libertarianism. And we're going to dive deep into all that in just a little bit. The reason that I'm bringing it up, though, is because Dave put into words a notion that I've had for quite some time, but I was never able to verbalize it. It never materialized for me. And Dave captured that, and I wanted to start with that. And it's this. In today's political and philosophical climate, the term voluntarism is actually far more useful to those of us who are trying to enlighten people than the term anarcho-capitalism. Now, they mean roughly the same thing, but voluntarism has a much better connotation, and it's much easier to draw people into your way of thinking if you use it instead of anarcho-capitalism. Think about it for a second. Try to go tell a friend that you're an anarcho-capitalist, and immediately that friend is going to think that you're an evil, greedy SOB whose only concern in the world is monetary profit. And then he'll start thinking about the anarchy part and go, oh gosh, not only are you a miser, but you're willing to bomb government buildings in order to get what you want. And so, of course, that's the absurd caricature that the mainstream media and the talking heads want you to think of when you hear the term. But we have to face facts that they've been really effective at painting that picture as being associated with the term anarcho-capitalist. So my argument is, why not use the term voluntarist or voluntarism instead? See, it still gets at the heart of libertarian philosophy, which is you can't use physical force against peaceful people, and that property rights are paramount. But there's no evil connotation that goes along with it. So from a purely marketing perspective, I think it's a better term than anarcho-capitalism, and it could possibly be a little bit more useful when we have discussions and debates with our family and friends. Don't tell them you're an anarcho-capitalist right off the bat. You're going to scare them away. Tell them you're a voluntarist, right? It's a sort of sleight of hand, or verbal sleight of hand, rather, that you can use to soften the outsides without softening the message, without watering down the principles. It's paramount that we never water down the principles, but if we have to change our marketing campaign a little bit here or there, well, I'm okay with that. So that's what brought it to my mind. I thought Dave did a phenomenal job of verbalizing that thought that had been in the back of my mind for so long. But aside from that marketing perspective of the usage of the term, we're going to spend the remainder of our time today discussing some of the logical conclusions that flow from the basic moral principle of voluntarism. First, you got to understand that the majority of your life is governed by voluntarism. Think about it. Think about the last week of your life, maybe the last month of your life. In your own human interactions with your neighbors, your family, friends, coworkers, did you ever have a time when you thought about physically forcing someone into an interaction that they didn't want? Well, the answer is most likely no. And the way I can be so sure about that is because the vast majority of people understand that using force is wrong. The vast majority of what you do with your life every single day operates under the theory of voluntarism. So for the rest of the discussion today, I want you to understand that we're going to be leaving the majority of your life aside for now. That peaceful portion of your life, we're going to leave that aside, and we're going to focus here on that other small portion of your life, and that's the portion that stems from forced or coerced interactions. So the very first thing we need to talk about, and it's at the forefront of my mind almost every day, is the notion of taxation. In a voluntarist world, taxation is seen as theft, plain and simple. You see, taxation at its root is an exchange of money in return for a grouping of services, but the exchange isn't voluntary. If you decide not to pay your taxes, you'll be fined. And if you decide not to pay the fine, you'll be physically pursued and eventually put in a cage. And if you resist that use of force while they try to put you in a cage, you'll be physically harmed and possibly killed. No matter how you slice it, taxation is not voluntary, okay? So voluntarists hold that taxation is theft, period. No ifs, ands, or buts. Now, not everyone's a voluntarist, so there are many arguments against that line of thinking, and I want to spend some time looking at those arguments and giving you the ammunition you need to properly think about this and combat the improper logic. All right, so the first argument against the taxation is theft claim is, well, taxation can't be theft because you receive something in return for it. Okay, it's pretty easy to smack this one down. That does not logically follow. Imagine you park your car in a bad part of town. You get out and you begin walking toward your destination, and all of a sudden you're approached by a gang of gangsters. And the gangsters tell you that, well, you've parked in the wrong part of town and, you know, your car is in danger, but they'll be happy to protect it for you for a small fee. And you're a smart guy, so you kindly decline. I mean, you don't believe there's that much danger to your car, and whatever, you don't mind. You have insurance, and you have a top-notch alarm system, so you really don't need that service, so you decline. Well, at that point, the gangsters then bring out a crowbar, and they start suggestively waving it around, not at you, not really threatening you with it, but they insinuate, well, what a shame it would be if something bad happened to your shiny car. And that's when you get it. That's when you understand this is a threat. If you don't pay them, your property will be damaged or taken away. You really don't want their services. You don't think you need it. But unless you comply, harm will come your way. So what do you do? Well, of course you acquiesce. You pay them. Now, was that transaction voluntary? I would say certainly not. Was it moral? No way. So you can plainly see that just because you receive something in exchange for your money, that doesn't make the transaction moral or in any way voluntary. So with taxation, yes, you're getting something in return for your money, but it's not moral and it's not voluntary. So what is the involuntary and immoral taking of your property? Well, we call that theft. Taxation is theft. All right, so that's the first argument, and that one's pretty easy to smack down. But the next one we want to talk about is the line of thinking goes like this. Well, taxation isn't theft because we voted our representatives into power, and they set the tax rates. Okay, there are a few problems with this line of thinking. Let's examine each of them one at a time. First, I'll stipulate. I'll accept that voting makes theft morally acceptable. Now, I don't actually think that, but I'm stipulating. So if we accept that at the outset, then now we have to look at those people who don't vote, right? Surely, even if we can say that voting makes theft morally acceptable, we couldn't extend that to people who don't vote, right? Surely we can't say that people who choose not to vote have also consented to the stealing of their property, right? So that doesn't make sense right off the bat. A small sidestep from that, and you can ask the question, what about those who did vote, but they voted for no taxation or less taxation? Does the fact that they lost the election mean that they've given up their rights to their property? Definitely not. These people may have been very happy to abstain from voting in the first place, but they only actually voted because they were under coercion that their property might be taken from them. So of course they go to the ballot box and they vote in a last-ditch effort, and it's a losing one. So do we now kick them in the teeth and say, well, you voted, so you consented? I mean, how barbaric is that? No, certainly not. In that case, whether you vote for it, or you don't vote, or you vote against it, there's no consent here just because there's a voting structure in place. Now, the second thing I want to talk about as it relates to voting specifically and how it relates to taxation is, I'm going to do this with a series of questions. So number one, why does voting legitimize an action that you'd otherwise find reprehensible? Why is majority rule considered to be moral, no matter what action is being voted into power? If the taking of someone else's property is wrong, how does voting change that? See, when you cast a vote to give someone else power, you're legitimizing the monopoly that they hold on the use of force over other people. It's so easy, but it's incredibly cowardly when you say, well, I would never take a gun over to my neighbor's house and rob them at gunpoint, even if my end goal was to be charitable and help poor people. You would never do that. That's reprehensible and immoral. But, if all the neighbors get together and they appoint a constable to go over to that neighbor's house, well, then it's okay. Then they can use a gun and take money from people because it's for a good cause, right? No, that doesn't follow. No one would think that that makes any sense. When you cast a vote, what you're essentially doing is you're transferring your greed and lust for someone else's property, someone else's labor, to henchmen, because you're too cowardly to carry out that task yourself. So I would argue that there's no basis in the line of thinking that because we vote people into power, somehow magically, something that's immoral now becomes moral. Okay? So I think that handles that line of thinking, and we're going to move on to the next one. So the next one that I get all the time is, well, I mean, taxation is authorized by the Constitution, and that governs all of us. But yet again, this logic falls flat on its face when you examine it with any level of rational thought. Let's begin. I would ask you, how am I governed by the Constitution? What is the Constitution? Is the Constitution anything other than a contract? I would say no. It's definitely a contract between the states that was written and ratified in the 18th century. Now, let's think about contracts for a minute. Some basic requirements for contracts include that all of the parties to the contract be well informed of its provisions, that they willingly and voluntarily consent to it, and that they show proof of that consent by signing their names to it. Another established rule of contracts that holds true in any jurisdiction is that all signatories to the contract be of sound mind to consent. And in most areas, being of sound mind to consent to a contract means you must have obtained the age of 18 years. Some places it's lower, 16, 15, I mean, it doesn't really matter, a number of years. So if you take all of that into account, how is it then possible that I, not having been born in 1789, am supposedly a party to this contract and under its jurisdiction, even when in 1806, 17 years later, it would have been unlawful for me to enter into that contract as a party? It's a ridiculous notion that I could possibly give my consent to a governing document that was created hundreds of years before my birth and age of legal consent. The truth is that there's nobody alive today who could ever be said to have consented to the Constitution. It's just not possible. Okay? So we've smashed that one as well. As soon as you make this argument, I promise you that if you're having a debate with someone, they will shift immediately and they'll say, well, the contract that really governs you is called the social contract, and it applies whether you sign it or not because you choose to live here. This is a really common one. We need to smash this one once and for all. So there's a planetary-sized hole in this argument. Let's get right into it. First, let's take a look at some various forms of contracts that exist today, and then we'll compare. So we'll start with a mortgage. So usually, when you obtain a mortgage, the process requires you to review dozens of legal documents with lawyers, realtors, possibly government officials, closing agents, and they do all of this to make absolutely certain that you understand the terms of this contract. They require you to be physically present at the closing ceremony, during which you must affix your signature in front of witnesses to dozens of pieces of paper. All of this to buy one piece of property. Yeah, it's a big piece of property, probably the biggest one you'll ever own, but it's still one piece of property, a relatively small portion of your life. Okay, what about a car? Well, when you buy a car, it's a little easier than buying a house, but nonetheless, you still have to sign your name to at least a dozen pieces of paper to make sure that you're willingly agreeing to the terms of the contract and you know what they are and you're well informed and yada yada, right? How about a marriage? Well, when you enter into a marriage contract, the state will force you to have witnesses to swear before a state official that you intend to uphold this contract under penalty of law and that you must verbally recite all of the conditions of that marriage contract. So mortgage, car, and marriage, three pretty typical contracts that you're gonna dive into here. They're all important, yes, but they're small parts of your overall life. So now let's compare that to the so-called social contract. In this apparently omniscient contract, which governs every single aspect of your life and has the right to rob you of your life, liberty, and property, you must sign exactly zero documents. You must prove to no one that you understand it, and you must show no evidence that your consent is voluntary. How is that possible? How does that stand up to reason? It doesn't. The truth is, the social contract is pure bunk. It does not exist. It's a fable, and it's a tool used by people who want to pull the wool over your eyes and convince you that you are to be governed. You are not to govern yourself. You are to be controlled. You are to be ruled. That's what the social contract is for. So don't let people use that argument. Feel free to smash it. Use all of these arguments to your benefit. All right, so the last one we're going to cover as it relates to taxation being theft, and this one kind of parlays off of the social contract. We hear this one just as frequently as we hear the social contract argument, and it's this. Well, you still live here, so you're agreeing to our way of life. If you don't like it, you can always leave. Yeah, like I've said, this is a really common one. When you hear this one, you know you're dealing with someone who's either incapable of logical, rational thought, or they're in a massive state of denial. Let's examine why. First of all, for anyone who was born in the United States, none of us had any choice in where we were born. Okay? There's no choice involved where you're brought into this world. If you were born in the US and you still live here, well, you didn't have a choice about that. Now, once you reach the age of 18, I guess someone with this line of thinking would argue that if you don't agree with the taxation or any other rule, then you have an obligation to move out. But the question then becomes, to what other location would I move? Every location in the world uses taxation to steal from the masses. There's nowhere you can go to escape the looting of your property. And furthermore, what if I can't afford it? What if my family situation dictates that it's just not possible? Do these circumstances make it morally acceptable to continue stealing from me? Of course not. Finally, let's look at another simple scenario that may help illustrate the point. What if an organized crime cartel slowly moves into your neighborhood and begins to take over and starts to assert power? At some point, the cartel begins to forcefully extract money from you under the threat of either higher bribes necessary or eventually physical violence. If you refuse to move from your own home in your own neighborhood, have you consented to that agreement? Can you say, well, you didn't move, so you must like what the cartel is doing? I don't think so. I wouldn't say that. The simple fact that you refuse to move does not show any sort of consent. This wicked arrangement happened without your agreement, and therefore, by definition, is non-consensual. So those are the main arguments to the notion of taxation being theft that you'll hear. And I hope I've covered from a logical standpoint, simple basic reasoning skills, why none of those arguments hold any water, okay? But at this point, one point about taxation remains. I mean, it does require a small discussion. We talked about every argument that someone would have if they made the argument that, well, taxation just isn't theft. You can't say taxation is theft. But there's a whole other group of people, albeit a little bit smaller, who would say, well, yeah, taxation is theft. You're right. It's theft. But the state has sovereignty, and so therefore they have the right to steal from you because they are the rulers. Now, I'm not going to spend a lot of time on this argument. There's really not much to say here, except to say that at least we know who these people are. At least they don't try to convince you that they are benevolent. They openly admit that they are stealing from you, and they deny that we live in a society that's governed by the people. Now, I don't agree with their line of thinking. I mean, I do believe that taxation is theft, of course, but I don't believe that the state has a right to do it. But hey, at least they're genuine. They're not hiding anything. Now, I would ask my listeners this question. Which camp do you fall into? Do you think taxation is theft? If you say, no, taxation isn't theft, I beg you to think long and hard about each of these arguments that I've made here today. I've been pretty thorough in responding to all of the major arguments you might hear when you try to prove that taxation is not theft. Take a couple days to think it over. But for those of you that said, well, taxation is indeed theft, but it's a legitimate function of our government, then how does that measure up to your preconceived notion that we live under a state that's granted its just powers by the consent of the governed? Is it possible to consent to theft? Isn't that an oxymoron? Isn't that a contradiction? Inherently, I would say, yes, that's a contradiction. It is not possible to consent to theft. It's one or the other. Indeed, if you've arrived at the conclusion that taxation is theft, but the state is entitled to carry it out, you must understand that you have arrived at an area where you no longer believe in a society that is governed by self-government. And that is a tough pill to swallow. So which is it? What camp do you fall into? That's it for this week. I'm going to wrap it up here. A little bit shorter episode. That's okay. I need to let you mull this one over for a bit, especially if you're not already in the voluntarist camp. I had intended to cover a few more aspects of voluntarism, but the discussion of taxation was really important, and I didn't want to cut it short. So we'll pick up more aspects of voluntarism in another episode. Don't worry. I think it's entirely possible that this could have been one of the most difficult episodes to listen to for a number of people. Not only is the topic thick and chewy and requires quite a bit of thought, but it flies in the face of everything we're taught in our government indoctrination centers as we've been growing up. And it's really hard to change the way that you think about this stuff. So I hope if you have questions, you'll reach out to me. When you're ready, tell me what you think. Tweet me at @MyBattleLiberty and we'll start a discussion. I'd love to hash it out with you. If Twitter isn't your cup of tea, email me at mike@battleforliberty.com. Make sure you subscribe to the podcast on iTunes and Stitcher, and please refer that friend. Get someone else listening. Spread the word about the battle for liberty. Until next time, battle on.